Leviathan, Part 2, Commonwealth, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 25 and 26. Chapter 25, Advice. The confusion between advice and commands is a prime example of how fallacious it is to judge of the nature of things by the ordinary unstable use of words. The confusion arises from the fact that the imperative mood is used in expressing both, and for many other purposes as well. For the words, "do this," are the words used not only by someone who commands, but also by someone who advises, and by someone who exhorts or earnestly tries to persuade. Yet nearly everyone sees that these are very different things, and can distinguish between them when he sees who is speaking, to whom he is speaking, and what the circumstances are. But finding such imperative forms in men's writings, and being unable or unwilling to think about the circumstances, people sometimes mistake the injunctions of advisers for the injunctions of those who command, and sometimes, on the contrary, take commands to be advice, depending on what fits best with the conclusions they are trying to draw or the actions they approve. To avoid such mistakes, and to give to those terms command, advise, and exhort their proper and distinct meanings, I define them thus. Command is where a man says, "Do this," or "Do not do this," relying on nothing but his own will. From this it follows, obviously, that someone who commands is claiming to benefit from it, because the reason for his command is simply his own will, and the proper object of every man's will is some good to himself. Advice is where a man says, "Do this," or "Do not do this," and bases his reasons on benefit that will come to the person to whom he says it. This makes it obvious that an adviser is claiming, whatever he actually intends, to bring good to the person whom he is advising. So one big difference between advice and command is that command is directed to one's own benefit, and advice to the benefit of someone else. From this arises another difference. A man may be obliged to do what he is commanded, for example, when he has covenanted to obey, but he can't be obliged to follow advice, because it will be he who loses if he does not follow it. What if he has covenanted to follow it? Then it is no longer advice, and comes to have the nature of a command. A third difference between them is that no man can claim to have a right to be another man's adviser, because he mustn't claim to benefit by the advice he gives. If you demand a right to advise someone, this demand is evidence that you want to know his designs, or to gain some other good to yourself, which, I repeat, is the exclusive object of every man's will. Another feature of advice is that no one can fairly be accused or punished for the advice he gives, whatever it may be. For to ask for someone's advice is to permit him to give what advice he thinks best, and consequently he who gives advice to his sovereign, whether a monarch or an assembly, when asked for it, cannot fairly be punished for giving it. This holds whether or not the advice fits with the opinion of the majority, as long as it's relevant to the proposition under debate. And generally, he who asks for advice is an author of it, and therefore can't punish the adviser for giving it. And what the sovereign can't do, no one else can do. But if one subject advises another to do something unlawful, that advice is punishable by the Commonwealth, whether it came from an evil intention or merely from ignorance, because ignorance of the law is not a good excuse where every man is obliged to know the laws to which he is subject. Exhortation is advice that is energetically pressed, that is, advice accompanied by signs that the person who gives it passionately desires to have it followed. Someone who exhorts doesn't spell out the consequences of the action he is advising the person to perform, so he doesn't tie himself to the rigour of true reasoning. He merely encourages the advisee to act in a certain way. So those who exhort in giving their reasons have an eye on the common passions and opinions of men, and they make use of comparisons, metaphors, examples, and other tools of oratory to persuade their hearers of the utility, honour, or justice of following their advice. From this it can be inferred, first, that exhortation aims at the good of the person who gives the advice, not the one who asks for it, which is contrary to the duty of an adviser, who, by the definition of advice, ought to be guided not by his own benefit, but by the advisee's. That the exhorter does direct his advice to his own benefit is clear enough from his long and passionate urging, or from his elaborately artful way of giving his advice. He was not required to give his advice in this manner. His doing so reflects his purposes, and consequently is directed principally to his benefit rather than to that of the advisee. We can infer, second, that exhortation is effective only where a man speaks to a multitude, because when the speech is addressed to one person, the hearer can interrupt the speaker and examine his reasons more rigorously than can be done in a crowd, which is too numerous to enter into dispute and dialogue with someone who is speaking to all of them at once. Third, it follows that those who exhort where they have been required to advise are corrupt advisers, having been bribed, so to speak, by their own interests. However good the advice given in an exhortation, he who gives it is not a good adviser, any more than someone who gives a just sentence in return for a bribe is a just judge. Where a man can lawfully command, as a father in his family, or a leader in an army, his exhortations are not only lawful, but also necessary and praiseworthy. But then they are no longer advice, but commands. When a command is given for the carrying out of very disagreeable work, it should be sweetened in the delivery by encouragement, and in the tone and phrasing of advice, rather than in the harsher language of command. Sometimes necessity requires this, and humanity always does. Examples of the difference between command and advice can be found in the forms of speech that express them in Holy Scripture. Have no other gods but me. Make for yourself no graven image. Take not God's name in vain. Sanctify the Sabbath. Honour your parents. Do not kill. Do not steal. And so on are commands, because the reason for which we are to obey them comes from the will of God, our King, whom we are obliged to obey. But these words, "Sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and follow me," are advice, because the reason for our doing so is drawn from our own benefit, namely, that if we comply, we shall have treasure in heaven. These words, "Go into the village over there, and you will find a tethered ass and her colt. Untie her, and bring her to me," are a command, because the reason for complying with it is drawn from the will of the speaker. But these words, "Repent and be baptized in the name of Jesus," are advice, because the reason for our doing so does not involve any benefit for God Almighty, who will still be King, however we rebel. It concerns benefit for ourselves, who have no other means of avoiding the punishment hanging over us for our sins. I have derived the difference between advice and command from the nature of advice, which consists in a laying out of the benefit or harm that may or must come to the advisee if he follows the advice. The differences between apt and inept advisers can be derived from the same source. Experience is just the memory of the consequences of similar actions formerly observed, and advice is just speech through which that experience is made known to someone else. So the virtues and defects of advice are the same as the virtues and defects of intellect, and for the person of a commonwealth, advisers serve in place of memory and thinking things through. But along with this resemblance of the commonwealth to a natural man, there is one very important dissimilarity. A natural man receives his experience from the natural objects of sense, which work on him without passion or interest of their own. whereas those who advise the representative person of a commonwealth may have, and often do have, their individual purposes and passions, which make their advice always suspect and often treacherous. So we can set down as the first requirement for a good adviser that his purposes and interests must not be inconsistent with those of the advisee. When an action is being deliberated, the role of an adviser is to make its consequences plain, so that the advisee is truly and clearly informed. So, secondly, an adviser ought to present his advice in such a way as to make the truth appear most clearly, that is, to present it with firm reasoning, in language that is as meaningful and proper and brief as the evidence will permit. The role of adviser, therefore, does not permit rash and unevident inferences, such as are fetched only from examples or from books taken as authoritative, none of which are evidence as to what is good or bad, but only witnesses of fact or of opinion. Nor does it permit obscure, confused, and ambiguous expressions, or metaphorical speeches, tending to the stirring up of passions. That is because such reasoning and such expressions serve only to deceive the advisee, or to lead him towards ends other than his own. The ability to advise well comes from experience and long study, and no man is presumed to have experience in everything that has to be known for the administration of a great commonwealth. Therefore, thirdly, no man is presumed to be a good adviser except on matters that he has had great experience of, and has thought about long and hard. This, properly understood, is a very demanding requirement. Foreseeing that the business of a commonwealth is to preserve the people in peace at home, and to defend them against foreign invasion, we shall find that it requires knowledge that can't be had without study. Great knowledge of human nature, of the rights of government, and of the nature of equity, law, justice, and honour. And that it requires knowledge that can't be had without much experience. Knowledge of the military strength, the economy, and the geography both of our own country and of our neighbours, and also of the inclinations and designs of all the nations that might in any way give us trouble. Knowledge of these things requires the observations of many men together. Finally, even when all these things are known, they are useless unless sound reasoning is employed, for nothing is useful to someone who doesn't know how to use it properly. Fourthly, for someone to advise the Commonwealth in matters of the greatest importance, he must have seen the archives of the Commonwealth, the records of treaties with neighbouring commonwealths, and the letters of ministers sent to neighbouring commonwealths to explore their plans. No one is permitted to see these things except those whom the sovereign wants to be permitted. So someone who is not customarily called on for advice can't give satisfactory advice, even if he is wise. Fifthly, when a man has several advisers, he will get better advice by hearing them one at a time than by listening to them in an assembly. There are many reasons for this, of which I shall present four. First, in hearing them singly, you get the advice of every man. But in an assembly, many of them give their advice only with aye or no, or with their hands or feet, moved not by their own thoughts, but by the eloquence of others, or by fear of giving displeasure by contradicting some who have spoken, or for fear of appearing duller in uptake than those who have applauded the contrary opinion. Second, most of them set their own advantage ahead of the public good. If they give their opinions separately, in private, this is less harmful, for the passions of individual men are more moderate taken separately than in an assembly, where they sometimes inflame one another by the hot air of their rhetoric, till they set the commonwealth afire, as burning brands give off less heat when they are separated than they do when joined. Third, in hearing each man separately, one can, when necessary, examine the truth or probability of his reasons for his advice, doing this by frequent interruptions and objections. That can't be done in an assembly, where in every difficult question a man is dazed and dazzled by the variety of inputs, rather than informed about what he ought to do. Besides, when a large assembly is called together to give advice, some will have an ambition to be thought eloquent, and also to be thought knowledgeable about policy, and their advice will be guided not by a care for the business under consideration, but by their desire for applause they can get for their orations. Motley affairs, made of the variously coloured threads or scraps of authors. This is at best an irrelevance, which takes away time from serious consultation, and it's easily avoided by taking advice in private. Fourth, in deliberations that ought to be kept secret, and there are many of those in public business, it's dangerous to take advice from many people, especially in assemblies, and therefore large assemblies are forced to put such affairs into the hands of a smaller number, choosing the most experienced and the most trustworthy. Summing up, who would ask for advice from a large assembly when there's a question of getting his children married, disposing of his lands, governing his household, or managing his private estate? Especially, who would want or accept this if some people in the assembly didn't wish him to prosper? A man who does his business with the help of many prudent advisers, consulting with each of them separately in private, does it best. And though it is true that many eyes see more than one, this doesn't imply an advantage in having many advisers, except when their advice is finally brought together by one man. In every other case, the many eyes are a drawback. Here is why. Many eyes see the same thing from different angles, and are apt to look obliquely towards their own private benefit. So those who don't want to miss their mark, though they look about with two eyes, always aim only with one, which means that they come to focus directly on their own purposes, with one eye on them and no eye on the public good. That is why no large democratic commonwealth has ever been kept up by the open consultations of the assembly. The maintenance of such commonwealths has always come from a foreign enemy that united them, or the reputation of some one eminent man amongst them, or the secret planning of a few, or their fear of splitting up into equal and thus uncontrollable factions. As for very small commonwealths, whether democratic or monarchical, once their strong neighbours become envious of them, no human wisdom can save them. Chapter 26. Civil Laws. By civil laws, I understand the laws that men are bound to observe because they are members of some commonwealth, not because they belong to this or that commonwealth in particular. Just as the laws of nature are those we are bound to obey because we are men, so civil laws are those we are bound to obey because we are citizens. The knowledge of the laws of any particular commonwealth belongs to that country's professional law scholars, but the knowledge of civil law in general belongs to any man. The ancient law of Rome was called their civil law from the word civitas, which signifies a commonwealth, and countries that came under the Roman Empire and were governed by that law still retain as much of it as they want, and call that the civil law, to distinguish it from the rest of their own civil laws. But that isn't what I want to talk about here. My purpose is not to show what is law in this country and in that, but what is law. That is what Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, and various others have done without becoming professional law scholars. The first point is that, obviously, law in general is not advice but command. It is not the case that any command by one man to another is a law. To count as law, a command must be addressed to someone who is already obliged to obey the commander. And as for civil law, that phrase adds only the name of the person commanding, who is the person of the commonwealth. With that in mind, I define civil law as follows. Civil law is to every subject the rules that the commonwealth has commanded him, by word, writing, or other sign, to use to distinguish right from wrong, that is, distinguishing what is in accordance with the rules from what is contrary to them. Every part of this definition is evident at first sight. Regarding the implication that something is a law to or for some person or group, anyone can see that some laws are addressed to all the subjects in general, some to particular provinces, some to particular vocations, and some to particular men, so that they are laws to everyone to whom the command is directed, and not to anyone else. It is also obvious that laws are the rules determining what is just or unjust, right or wrong, for nothing is counted as unjust unless it's contrary to some law. Likewise, that only the Commonwealth can make laws, because it's the only thing we are subject to, and that commands must be signified by sufficient signs, because otherwise a man doesn't know how to obey them. So anything that can be rigorously deduced from this definition ought to be acknowledged as true. Here are the 8 things that I deduce from it. First, the only legislator in any commonwealth is the sovereign, whether that is one man in a monarchy, or one assembly of men in a democracy or aristocracy. For the legislator is he who makes the law, and only the commonwealth prescribes and commands that the rules we call law be obeyed. Therefore the commonwealth is the legislator. But the commonwealth isn't a person, and can't do anything except through its representative, the sovereign. And therefore the sovereign is the only legislator. For the same reason, only the sovereign can repeal a law that has been made, because the only way to repeal a law is to make a second law forbidding the enforcement of the first. Second, the sovereign of a commonwealth, whether an assembly or one man, is not subject to the civil laws. Suppose that he were subject to them. Having the power to make and repeal laws, he could free himself from subjection to them whenever he pleased, by repealing the laws that troubled him, and making new ones. So he was free from subjection to them all along. For someone who can be free, whenever he likes, is free. No person can be bound to himself, because he who can bind can also release, and therefore someone who is bound only to himself is not bound at all. Third, when a time-honoured practice comes to have the authority of a law, what makes the authority isn't the length of time, but the will of the sovereign as signified by his silence. For silence is sometimes evidence of consent. And as soon as the sovereign speaks up against it, it is no longer law. And, therefore, if the sovereign is involved in a legal issue based not on his present will, but on existing laws, the outcome should not be affected by how long some legal state of affairs has been allowed to stand. The outcome should be reached on the basis of equity, that is, distributing to each man what is rightly his. For many unjust actions and unjust judicial sentences go uncorrected for longer than any man can remember. Only our reasonable customs are counted by our lawyers as laws. They maintain that bad customs should be abolished, but the judgment of what is reasonable and of what ought to be abolished belongs to him who makes the law, namely, the sovereign assembly or the monarch. Fourth, the law of nature and the civil law contain each other, and are of equal extent. For the laws of nature, which consist in equity, justice, gratitude, and other moral virtues depending on these, are in the raw condition of nature not properly laws, but rather qualities that dispose men to peace and to obedience. They become laws when a commonwealth is established, and not before. And then the commonwealth commands them, and so they become civil laws, for it's the sovereign power that obliges men to obey them. For when private men have disagreements, the ordinances of sovereign power are needed to lay down what is equitable, what is just, and what is morally virtuous, and to make the ordinances binding, and to ordain punishments for those who break them. Those ordinances, therefore, also being part of the civil law. So the law of nature is a part of the civil law in all commonwealths of the world. Conversely, the civil law is a part of the dictates of nature. For justice, that is, performing covenants and giving to every man his own, is a dictate of the law of nature. But every subject in a commonwealth has covenanted to obey the civil law, and therefore obedience to the civil law is part also of the law of nature. Civil law and natural law are not different kinds of law, but different parts of law. The written part is called civil, the unwritten part natural. But the civil law can abridge and restrain the right of nature, that is, the natural liberty of man. Indeed, the whole purpose of making civil laws is to create such restraints, without which peace is impossible. And law was brought into the world solely in order to limit the natural liberty of particular men, in such a way that they don't hurt, but rather assist one another, and join together against a common enemy. Fifth, if the sovereign of one commonwealth subdues a people who have lived under other written laws, and afterwards governs them by those other laws, then they become the civil laws of the victor, and not of the vanquished commonwealth. For the legislator isn't the person by whose authority the laws were first made, but the one by whose authority they now continue to be laws. So where the dominion of a commonwealth includes different provinces with different laws, commonly called the customs of each province, we should not think that such customs have force as laws, purely because of how long they have been in existence. The right way to view them is this. They are laws that were written or otherwise made known long ago, under the decrees and statutes of their sovereigns at that time. And they are now laws not because they have been validated by time, but rather by virtue of the decrees of their present sovereign. But if an unwritten law is generally observed throughout all the provinces of a dominion, and there appears to be nothing bad in this, that law must be a law of nature, and equally binding on all mankind. Sixth, given that all laws, written and unwritten, have their authority and force from the will of the commonwealth, that is, from the will of the monarch or the sovereign assembly, you may well wonder about the opinions that are found in books by eminent lawyers in several commonwealths, which say outright, or imply, that the legislative power depends on private men or subordinate judges. I shall give two examples of such opinions. Some have written that the only controller of the common law is the Parliament, which is true only where a Parliament has the sovereign power and can't be assembled or dissolved except by their own discretion. For if anyone else has a right to dissolve them, he also has a right to control them, and consequently to control their controllings. And if there is no such right for them to dissolve themselves, then the controller of laws is not Parliament, but the King in Parliament. And where a Parliament is sovereign, it can't give legislative power to some other assembly, even if for some purpose it brings together from its dominions ever so many men who are ever so wise. Nobody will believe that such an assembly has thereby acquired a legislative power. My second example. Some have written that the two arms of a commonwealth are force and justice, the former belonging to the king and the latter to the Parliament. As if a commonwealth could hold together when its force was in hands that justice didn't command and govern. Seventh, our legal writers agree that law can never be against reason, and that the law should be identified not with the letter of the law, but with what the legislator intended. This is true, but there's a question about whose reason it is that shall be accepted as law. They don't mean that any private person's reason generates law, for then there would be as much contradiction in the laws as there is in the schools. Sir Edward Coke ties law to an acquired perfection of reason, achieved, as his was, by long study, observation, and experience. But this is wrong, for long study might increase and confirm erroneous judgments, and when men build on false grounds, the more they build, the greater is the ruin. Also, even when men have studied and observed for equal amounts of time, and with equal diligence, they are certain to end up with reasons and resolutions that conflict. What makes the law, therefore, is not the wisdom of subordinate judges, but rather the reason and command of this artificial man of ours, the Commonwealth. And because the Commonwealth is just one person, the representative, there can't easily arise any contradiction in the laws. And when one does occur, that same reason can remove it by interpretation or alteration. In all courts of justice, the sovereign, the person of the Commonwealth, is the one who judges. Any subordinate judge ought to base his judgment on the reason that moved his sovereign to make such a law. If he does, then it's his sovereign's judgment, and if it isn't, then the judgment is his own and is unjust. 8th. The command of the Commonwealth is law only to those who are equipped to understand it. That is because the law is a command, and a command is a declaration or expression of the commander's will. There is no law over mentally deficient people, children or madmen, any more than there is over brute beasts. None of those can deserve the label just or unjust, because they have never had power to make any covenant, or to understand the consequences of one, so they have never undertaken to authorize the actions of any sovereign, which is what must be done by those who make a commonwealth. Just as those who are constitutionally unable to understand any laws are excused for not obeying the laws, so also someone who has, through some event that was not his fault, been deprived of the means to take in some particular law, is excused for not obeying it. Strictly speaking, to him it isn't a law. So we must consider now what evidence and signs are sufficient for knowing what the law is, that is, knowing what is the will of the monarch or sovereign assembly. First, if it is a law that binds all the subjects, and is not made public in places where they can see it, it is a law of nature. For something that men are to recognize as a law, not on the strength of other men's words, but each on the basis of his own reason, must be agreeable to the reason of all men, and the only law that can be that is the law of nature. So the laws of nature needn't be published or proclaimed, because they are all contained in this one sentence approved by all the world: Do not do to anyone else something you think it would be unreasonable for anyone to do to you. Secondly, if it is a law that binds only men of some kind, or only one particular man, and is not written or published in verbal form, then it too is a law of nature. And the evidence and signs that make it known also mark out the person or kind of person bound by this law. For any law that isn't written, or somehow published by the legislator, can only be known by the reason of him who is to obey it, and so it's a natural law as well as a civil one. For example, if the sovereign employs a public minister without instructing him in writing what to do, the minister is obliged to take the dictates of reason as instructions. If the sovereign makes someone a judge, the judge should realize that his judgments ought to be according to the reason of his sovereign, and since that is always understood to be equity, he is bound to it by the law of nature. Or if the sovereign appoints an ambassador, the ambassador is, in everything not covered by his written instructions, to regard as instruction anything his reason tells him best serves his sovereign's interests, and similarly with all other ministers of the sovereignty, public and private. All these instructions of natural reason can be brought under one name, fidelity, which is a branch of natural justice. It belongs to the essence of all laws, except the law of nature, to be made known to everyone who will be obliged to obey them, by speech or writing or some other act known to come from the sovereign authority. For the will of someone else can't be understood except through his own word or act, or by conjectures based on what one knows about his scope and purpose. And when it's the person of the Commonwealth, the purpose should be supposed always to conform to equity and reason. In ancient times, before writing was in common use, the laws were often put into verse, so that uneducated people, taking pleasure in singing or reciting them, might remember them more easily. It isn't enough that the law be written and published. There must also be clear signs that it comes from the will of the sovereign. For private men, when they have, or think they have, enough force to secure their unjust plans and carry them safely through to their ambitious goals, can publish as laws anything they like. So there needs to be not only a declaration of the law, but also sufficient signs of who the author is and of his authority. In every commonwealth, it's supposed to be obvious who the author, the legislator, is, because he is the sovereign, who is supposed to be well enough known by everyone, because he became sovereign by the consent of everyone. No excuse for law-breaking can be based on ignorance of where the sovereignty is placed. It is true that most men are sufficiently ignorant and complacent not to think about whose power defends them against their enemies, protects the fruits of their labour, and sets things to rights when they have been wronged. Still, anyone who does give it a thought must realise who it is. Furthermore, it's a dictate of natural reason, and consequently an evident law of nature, that no man ought to weaken the power whose protection against others he has himself demanded or knowingly accepted. Therefore, whatever may be suggested to the contrary by bad men, no one can be in any doubt about who is sovereign, or if anyone is, it is by his own fault. Any such doubt concerns the evidence of the authority derived from the sovereign, and that can be removed by knowledge of the public registers, public councils, public ministers, and public seals, by which all laws are sufficiently verified. I say verified, not authorized, for the things I have listed are merely the testimony and record of the law, not its authority, which consists purely in the command of the sovereign. So if a man has a question about whether a certain action wrongs someone, where this depends on the law of nature, that is, on common equity, the judgment of the judge authorized to hear such cases is a sufficient verification of the law of nature in that individual case. For though the advice of a legal scholar may be useful for avoiding contention, it's still only advice. It is for the judge to hear the controversy and tell men what the law is. But when a man is contemplating a certain action, he can consult the law books, or have someone consult them for him, in order to learn whether the proposed action would be a crime, or would wrong someone, according to a written law. Indeed, he ought to do so, for when a man is unsure whether the act he is planning is just or unjust, and can inform himself if he wants to, the action is unlawful if he goes ahead and performs it without further inquiry. For every man is obliged to do his best to inform himself of all written laws that may concern his own future actions. Similarly, with someone who thinks he has been wronged, in a case that falls under the written law, he should look up the law for himself, or have someone do it for him. For if he complains before consulting the law, he acts unjustly, and reveals a disposition to make trouble for others, rather than to demand his own right. If there is a question about obedience to a public officer, his authority is sufficiently verified by seeing his commission with the public seal, and hearing it read, or by having the means to be informed of it. With the legislator known, and the laws sufficiently published, either in writing or by the light of nature, there's one further very important requirement for them to be obligatory. For the nature of the law consists not in the letter of the law, but in the meaning, the authentic interpretation of the law, which is the sense of the legislator. So the interpretation of all laws depends on the sovereign authority, and interpreters must be appointed by the sovereign, to whom alone the subject owes obedience. Otherwise, an ingenious interpreter could make the law bear a sense contrary to that of the sovereign, by which means the interpreter would become the legislator. All laws, written and unwritten, need interpretation. The unwritten law of nature is easy to understand, for those who impartially and coolly make use of their natural reason, so violators of it have no excuse. And yet, because most, if not all, people are sometimes blinded by self-love or some other passion, the law of nature has become the most obscure of all laws, and consequently has the greatest need for able interpreters. Short-written laws are easily misinterpreted, because of the different meanings of a word or two. Long ones are even more obscure, because of the different meanings of many words. So that no written law, whether expressed in few words or in many, can be well understood without a perfect understanding of the purposes for which the law was made, and the knowledge of those purposes lies with the legislator. The interpretation of the laws of nature in a commonwealth doesn't depend on books of moral philosophy. If a writer doesn't have the authority of the commonwealth, whatever authority he does have is not enough to make his opinions law, however true they may be. What I have written in this book concerning the moral virtues, and how they are needed for procuring and maintaining peace, is clearly true. But its truth makes it law only because in all commonwealths it is part of the civil law. For although it is naturally reasonable, the sovereign power is what makes it law. Otherwise, that is, if the natural law were to be definitively found in books, it would be a great error to call the laws of nature unwritten law, when we see so many volumes about it published, and in them so many contradictions of one another and of themselves. The interpretation of the law of nature is the judgment of the judge assigned by the sovereign authority to hear and determine any controversies that depend on the law of nature, and it consists in the application of the law to the present case. For in the act of judging, all the judge does is to consider whether the demand of the party is consistent with natural reason and equity, so his judgment is the interpretation of the law of nature. This interpretation is authentic, not because it's his private judgment, but because he gives it by the sovereign's authority, which turns it into the sovereign's judgment, which for that time is the law. But any judge, whether subordinate or sovereign, can err in a judgment of equity, that is, in a judgment about the law of nature. If a judge does err, and then in a similar later case he finds it better to give a contrary judgment, he is obliged to do that. No man's error becomes his own law, nor obliges him to persist in it. Nor, for the same reason, does an error concerning the law of nature become a law to other judges, even if they are sworn to follow it. If a wrong judgment is given by authority of the sovereign, in connection with mutable law, that is, civil law, and if the sovereign knows about this and allows it, this creates a new law covering all cases that are exactly the same as the case where the error occurred. But errors in connection with immutable laws, such as the laws of nature, are not laws, to the judge who made the error, or to other judges, in similar cases for ever after. Princes succeed one another. One judge goes and another comes. Indeed, heaven and earth may pass away, but not the least fragment of the law of nature shall pass, for it is the eternal law of God. Therefore all the judgments that previous judges have ever made cannot unite to make a law contrary to natural equity, nor can any examples of former judges warrant an unreasonable sentence, or spare the present judge the trouble of studying what is equitable, in the case before him, from the principles of his own natural reason. A great lawyer for the common law of England, Sir Edward Coke, has written this:
"Suppose an innocent man is accused of felony, and runs away out of fear of the consequences of the accusation, and eventually is judicially acquitted of the felony. If it's found that he fled because of the accusation of felony, he shall, despite his innocence, forfeit all his goods, chattels, debts, and duties, for the law will not allow any evidence opposing the forfeiture to outweigh the presumption in law based on his flight."
Here you see an innocent man being condemned, after having been judicially acquitted, to lose all his goods. No written law forbade him to flee, but the forfeiture of his goods is based on a presumption in law. If the law takes his flight to be a basis for a presumption, that he was guilty of the act of which he was accused, which was a capital offence, the sentence ought to have been not mere forfeiture of goods, but death. And if it wasn't a presumption of guilt, why ought he to lose his goods? So this is no law of England, and the basis for the condemnation is not a presumption of law, but a presumption of the judges. Furthermore, it's against law to say that no evidence shall be admitted against a presumption of law. For any judge, sovereign, or subordinate, who refuses to hear evidence, is refusing to do justice. For even if the final judgment is just, judges who condemn without hearing the evidence are unjust, and their presumption is mere prejudice. There are other things like this, where men's judgments have been perverted by trusting to precedents, but this one is enough to show that although the judgment of the judge is a law to the party pleading, it is not law to any judge who follows him in that office. Similarly, when there is a question about the meaning of written laws, the man who writes a commentary on them isn't their interpreter. For commentaries are often open to even more questions and difficulties than the text is, so they need commentaries in their turn, and there will be no end of such interpretations. And therefore, unless the sovereign authorizes an interpreter whose interpretations the subordinate judges are to accept, the interpreter will have to be the ordinary judges, just as they are for the cases of the unwritten law. If the wording of a law doesn't fully authorize a reasonable judgment, the judge ought to fill the gap with the law of nature, or, in a difficult case, to postpone judgment until he gets fuller authority. For example, a written law ordains that someone who is forced out of his house shall be restored by force. It happens that a man, by negligence, leaves his house empty, and on returning to it is kept out by force. A situation that isn't addressed by any special law. It is evident that this case falls under the same law, so that force can be used to give him occupancy of his house again, for otherwise there's no legal remedy for him at all, which we can suppose is against the intention of the legislator. Another example. The word of the law commands the judge to judge according to the evidence. Now, suppose a man is falsely accused of an act which the judge himself saw done by someone other than the accused man. And suppose also that there are witnesses whose testimony provides some evidence that the accused man is guilty. In this case, it would not be right for the judge to follow the letter of the law and condemn an innocent man, or to flout the letter of the law by delivering an acquittal against the evidence of the witnesses. What he should do, rather, is to arrange for the sovereign to appoint someone else as judge in this case, and present himself as a witness, so that a disadvantage created by the bare words of a written law may lead him to a better interpretation of what the law means, but it could not justify him in making a judgment that goes against the law, for a judge of right and wrong is not judge of what is advantageous or disadvantageous to the commonwealth. The abilities required in a good interpreter of the law, that is, in a good judge, are not the same as those of a lawyer, namely, book-learning about the laws. A judge ought to base his views about the facts purely on what the witnesses say, and to base his views about the law purely on the statutes and constitutions of the sovereign, not as found in law books, but as formally presented to him by parties to the court case, or declared to him by people who are available during the court case, and who have authority from the sovereign power to declare them. He need not be concerned in advance about what he shall judge, for he will learn from witnesses what to say about the facts, and what he is to say regarding the law. He will learn from litigants who present points of law, and from those who by authority interpret the law for him on the spot, not in advance. The Lords of Parliament in England were judges, and most difficult cases have been heard and settled by them. Yet few of them had done much study of the laws, and fewer still were lawyers by profession. And though they consulted with lawyers summoned for that purpose, they, the Lords, alone had authority to pass judgment. Similarly, in ordinary trials of legal matters, 12 men of the common people are the judges, and pass judgments not only on the facts, but also on the law, simply giving a verdict for the complainant or for the defendant. And in criminal cases, these 12 men determined not only whether or not the alleged act was done, but also whether it is murder, homicide, felony, assault, and the like, which are judgments of law. because they are not supposed to know the law themselves, there is someone with authority to inform them about it, as it applies to the present case. But if they don't judge according to what he tells them, that does not make them liable to any penalty, unless it is shown that they did it against their consciences or had been corrupted by bribes. The things that make a good judge, or good interpreter of the laws, are the following. Firstly, a right understanding of that principal law of nature called equity. Such an understanding comes not from reading other men's writings, but from the goodness of a man's own natural reason and meditation. So it is presumed to be greatest in those who have had most time and inclination to think about equity. Secondly, a disregard for unnecessary riches and ranks. Thirdly, the ability, when judging, to set aside all fear, anger, hatred, love, and compassion. Fourthly and lastly, patience in listening, diligent attention to what one hears, and memory to retain, digest, and apply what one has heard. Laws can be divided into natural and positive. Natural laws are the ones that have been laws from all eternity. As well as natural, they are also called moral. They underlie the moral virtues such as justice and equity, and all habits of the mind that are conducive to peace and charity. Positive laws are the ones that have not held from eternity, but have been made laws by the will of those who had sovereign power over others. They are either written or made known to men by some other evidence of the will of their legislator. Positive laws divide into human and divine, and human positive laws can be further divided into distributive and penal. Distributive laws determine the rights of the subjects, telling every man what it is that enables him to acquire and keep ownership of land or goods, and gives him a right or liberty of action, and these laws speak to all the subjects. Penal laws declare what penalty is to be inflicted on those who violate the law. They speak to the ministers and officers appointed to enforce penalties. Everyone ought to be informed about the punishments that have been set in advance for his transgression. But the law is a command, and a command is addressed not to the delinquent, who can't be expected to dutifully punish himself, but to public ministers appointed to see that the penalty is enforced. Natural laws are eternal and universal, so they are all divine. And the distinction between human and divine applies only to positive laws. Divine positive laws are commandments of God, not from all eternity, and addressed not to all men, but only to a certain people or to certain individuals, which are declared to be such by those whom God has authorized to declare them. How can we know that a given man has authority to declare what are these positive laws of God? God can command a man, in a supernatural way, to pass on laws to other men. But it's of the essence of law that someone who is to be bound by a law shall be assured of the authority of the person who declares it, and there's no natural way for us to see that the authority comes from God. So two questions arise. How can a man, without supernatural revelation, be assured that what the declarer of the law has received was a revelation? And how can he be bound to obey these supposed divine positive laws? The answer to the first question is that he can't. For one man to be rightly sure that another man had had a revelation, he would have to have learned this from a revelation of his own. We may be induced to believe that someone had such a revelation from the miracles we see him do, or from seeing the extraordinary sanctity of his life, or from seeing the extraordinary wisdom or extraordinary fortunateness of his actions, all of which are marks of God's extraordinary favour. But they are not proof positive of special revelation. Miracles are marvellous works, but what is marvellous to one person may not be marvellous to another. Sanctity can be feigned, and the visible good things of this world are usually produced by God through natural and ordinary causes, rather than through supernatural revelation. So no man can infallibly know, through natural reason, that another man has had a supernatural revelation of God's will. All we can have is a belief more or less confident depending on the strength of the evidence. But the second question, how can he be bound to obey them, is not so hard. It is obvious why we ought to obey those who proclaim things as divine and supernatural. Why we ought to obey, that is, at some times and in some places, namely, where the Commonwealth has ordered us to regard as laws the things those people proclaim. For by natural law, which is also divine, we are to obey the Commonwealth in everything it commands, though we are not commanded by natural law to believe. No one can be bound or obliged to believe anything, for men's beliefs and inner thoughts are not subject to commands, but only to the operation of God, whether ordinary or extraordinary. When we have faith that something is a supernatural law, we are not obeying that law, but only assenting to it. And this assent is not a duty that we perform for God, but a gift which he freely makes to whomever he pleases, just as unbelief is not a breach of any of his laws, but rather a rejection of all of them except the natural laws. There are examples in Holy Scripture which show that in a commonwealth, a subject who has not personally received a certain and assured revelation of the will of God should obey the commands of the commonwealth as though they were based on such a revelation. And he should not regard anything else as a divine revelation. For if men were at liberty to take their own dreams and fancies to be God's commandments, or the dreams and fancies of other private men, there would hardly be any two men who agreed on what is God's commandment. And yet because of these views of theirs, they would all despise the commandments of the Commonwealth. I conclude, therefore, that in everything not contrary to the moral law, that is, contrary to the law of nature, all subjects are bound to obey the laws the Commonwealth says are divine laws. You can see that this is obviously right by thinking about it. Whatever isn't against the law of nature can be made law in the name of those with the sovereign power, and there's no reason why men should be less obliged by it when it is presented in the name of God. Besides, in no country in the world are men permitted to claim as commandments of God anything that hasn't been declared as such by the Commonwealth. Christian states punish those who revolt from the Christian religion, and all other states punish those who set up any religion the state has forbidden. Why would a state forbid a particular religion? Because the alternative would be unacceptable religious freedom. In whatever isn't regulated by the Commonwealth, every man can equally enjoy his liberty. That is a matter of equity, which is the law of nature, and therefore an eternal law of God. Laws are also divided into fundamental and not fundamental, though I have never found in any author a coherent account of what fundamental law means. Still, we can very reasonably distinguish laws in that manner, or, more accurately, under that terminology. For in any commonwealth, a fundamental law is one that cannot be removed without the commonwealth failing, being demolished like a building whose foundation is destroyed. Thus, a fundamental law is one which binds subjects to uphold every power that is given to the sovereign, whether a monarch or a sovereign assembly, and is needed for the commonwealth to survive, such as the power of making war and peace, of judicature, of election of officers, and of doing whatever the sovereign thinks necessary for the public good. A law is not fundamental if it could be repealed without that leading to the collapse of the commonwealth, such as the laws concerning controversies between subject and subject. That completes what I have to say about the classification of laws. End of chapter 26.